You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 25th of January. I'm your host for today, Shimena, and I'm joined in studio by my producer for today, Dylan. So the government announced yesterday that the minimum wage will be going up 50 cents on April the 1st. We talked to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, Michael Woodhouse, about this, as well as the Council of Trade Unions President, Richard Wagstaff. We have our weekly Wednesday feature, Dear Science. Professor Alan Blackman will be back again this week to talk about a range of topics, including new temperature extremes and stories of medical quackery. We look at how some of the signage and symbolism used during the Women's March in the weekend was a little bit problematic and insensitive to the trans community in New Zealand, as well as the rest of the world. And finally, we talk about emerging geothermal technologies in New Zealand. If you want to let us know your thoughts about any of the things we cover today, please give us a call. 309 3879 is the number, or give us a text on 5395.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
But first up, today on the show, we're continuing our coverage about Nikki's eviction. If you tuned into The Wire over the last 2 days, then you would have heard about her story. Nikki is a woman living in a state house in Glen Innes who's being evicted from her home. This is because the Tamaki Regeneration Company, a joint venture between the government and Auckland Council, have plans to redevelop the area. Now, I have Tamaki Regeneration Company's general housing manager, Neil Porteous, live on the phone with me. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Samantha. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
So first of all, why does the Tamaki Regeneration Company want Nikki to leave her home?
So as part of our regeneration program, we're developing or building 7,500 houses across Tamaki. Now, in order to do that, we need to remove some of the houses people are currently living in. But having said that, we do have a commitment to the people of Tamaki that if we do need the house for redevelopment, then we'll move them to another house within Tamaki. So basically, we'd like Ms. Rowte to move into another house within Tamaki so we can build new houses on the site that her current house currently occupies.
So it's within Tamaki, or is it still within the suburb of Glen Innes?
Well, the commitment we've made is within Tamaki, but wherever possible, we try and work with families to keep them within the area or the neighbourhood that they're currently in, if they want to stay in that neighbourhood.
So do you not think the process of moving for an elderly lady experiencing arthritis is a stressful one?
Oh, we absolutely acknowledge that this is very, very challenging for Ms. Rowte, and we believe that we've tried very hard to engage with her since July when we first notified her of our need to move her to a new house. But unfortunately, Ms. Rowte has decided not to engage with us through this process, which makes the rehousing very difficult.
And so is it not possible for the Tamaki Regeneration Company to build around Nikki's home so she can stay?
No, unfortunately, that's not possible, Shimena. We've got undertakings and contracts with the developers that are already in existence, and they need access to that site to be able to build the new properties on it.
And also, you've given her houses as possibilities that she can move into, though.
Yes.
Will she be moving back to the area in one of the new state homes being built, or so? Are you moving to her to a temporary accommodation and then back to one of the newer state houses, or?
Well, one of the houses we have on offer is a new house, and it's 700 metres down the road from where Ms. Rowte currently lives. In some situations, we do need to move families into older houses while their new houses are being built. But again, because Ms. Rowte hasn't been entered into a dialogue with us, it's very hard to understand her needs. But we're very keen for her to get in touch so we can discuss her rehousing needs and work with her.
From what I understand, though, she says that the houses that she's been offered so far aren't really up to par. So one of them was partly flooded when she went to see it, and another had stairs, which she can't get up because of her arthritis. So...
Yes.
How do you respond to that?
So I guess my response to that is it's important for us. I heard both of those comments through the media this week. Unfortunately, we hadn't heard that when the houses were offered, and we can work with tenants in these situations to modify houses to meet any accessibility needs. But again, Shemina, it's very difficult to do that when the tenant concerned won't engage with us.
And so as for the others currently in the 2,600 state homes in Tamaki, will they all be relocated to new state homes being built in the same area, or will they be dispersed outside of the Tamaki area?
So our commitment is that if you live in a social home that's affected by redevelopment and you remain eligible for social housing, then the commitment is that you'll be able to stay in Tamaki. So, and we're very clear about that. And we are consistently working with families to delivering on that promise.
And also, so the Tamaki Regeneration Company plans to boost the numbers of houses in the area from the 2,600 state homes that exist currently to 7,500 new homes, which will be a mix of state houses and private houses.
Yeah.
So will these private houses be being built? Will they be affordable to the average Kiwi? Like, what prices will these be expected to be approximately?
So, we don't talk about price points. We talk about affordability, and there's a number of initiatives that we're just designing in order to make a proportion of those houses affordable.
Okay. And what? But ultimately, some people have just been criticising this process as one of gentrification. How do you respond to that?
Well, we work very hard with the Tamaki community to avoid that. It's very important to us that we maintain the spirit and the culture of the community. And for example, one of the key initiatives is that it's called mixed tenure, where we won't be where social housing tenants will be living next to people who've bought their houses privately and people who bought the affordable housing. So I understand people's concerns, but we're working very hard with the community to avoid that and to maintain the very special culture that exists within Tamaki.
So people currently in state homes, they'll be hoping to stay there far into the future?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Tamaki is an awesome place, and we want for it to continue to be so.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me on the show today,
okay.
Neil. You have a good day.
Thank you very much, Rana. Thanks for your time.
All right.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
So we just heard from the Tamaki Regeneration Company's General Housing Manager, Neil Porteous, who was speaking about the coverage that we've, or about the issue, sorry, about Nikki's eviction that's been in the media this week. So thank you very much for Neil coming onto the show today. Next up, the government announced yesterday a 50-cent rise in the minimum wage to $15.75 an hour, which will be implemented on April the 1st. This comes after a similar rise of 50 cents was implemented at the same time last year. Yesterday, I spoke to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, Michael Woodhouse, about the move. I started by asking him if 50 cents is the magic number for incremental changes to the minimum wage.
Look, I don't think it can be presumed it's going to be 50 cents each year. Obviously, there are a number of variables that need to be taken into account. Economic conditions are one of them. Inflation, obviously. Previous government always talks about the fact that they increased by more, but of course they weren't able to control inflation. What we look at is a balance of issues, balancing affordability and the fact that the employers are the ones paying this largely, with the stated goal of government to try and increase minimum wages on a regular basis and preferably ahead of inflation. I think we've achieved that balance.
And so what prompted the government's move to raise the minimum wage?
Well, this is an annual process. On the 1st of April each year, the government makes changes, if it sees fit, to the minimum wage and to the starting out wage. We go through a process of reviewing that, consulting with unions, employer groups, and the prevailing climate, and then a recommendation is made to Cabinet. That went to Cabinet late last year, and I made the announcement today.
And so it's just a coincidence that it's in an election year then?
Absolutely. We've done it every year ahead of the rate of inflation since we've become government. It hasn't always been 50 cents. That's been the prevailing number. But I think on one occasion when inflation was very benign, it was 25 cents. But on a percentage basis, it's this year 3.3%. Inflation's running about 0.4%. So I think it's a pretty good signal that real wages for those at that lowest level are going to go up.
And so house prices in New Zealand went up 12.5% last year, according to QV data. Will the 3.3% minimum wage increase to $15.75 be enough to help New Zealanders keep up with the rising costs of housing?
Well, what you're presuming is that people on the minimum wage are house owners or house buyers. Now, what tends to happen is the 120,000-odd people who are on the minimum wage are students working part-time, school students, people starting out in the workforce. For those that do have accommodation requirements and family commitments, there are a number of other things that the government does. There are accommodation supplements, income-related rents, working for families, and of course we've lowered the income tax levels for those in the lower wage brackets. So this is part of a range of measures, and in and of itself, it might not seem to be solving issues around housing affordability, but I think it should be looked at in the context of that broader range of issues that the government deals with.
So you think solving issues of wealth inequality and housing affordability in New Zealand is better addressed by wage subsidies and accommodation subsidies and initiatives like working for families, for example?
Well, the government is not the payer of most of these wages. Let's firstly put that out there. What we want to do is create a framework that is conducive to employers taking the chance on growth in their business, therefore increasing the number of staff they need, increasing the productivity that warrants increases in wages. Remember, what we're talking about here is a minimum wage, and it affects fewer than 5% of the more than 2.4 million people who are wage and salary earners in this country. So I think we've got to look at it as in that context. It's one of the highest minimum wages in the OECD, particularly relative to the average wage, and I'm quite satisfied that it's a generous change today.
And so there are a number of different groups, though, saying a living wage of $19.80 is needed instead as the base wage in New Zealand, and that the 50-cent increase proposed today isn't enough. How do you respond to this?
Well, look, for those who can afford the living wage or who create the sorts of climates for their staff to be able to earn them, that is great. But remember that the living wage is targeted on the basis of two adults, two children families. But they only make up a small proportion of families earning less than the living wage. And a living wage would most likely benefit young people with no kids and because they're doing the part-time, the casual work. The government has a range of other supports to prop up wages for the small number of people who are in family situations, like working for families. So I think living wage is a noble goal, but I don't think it should be mandated.
And also those pushing for the living wage, they say that $19.80 is what's needed to live with dignity. Do you think those earning below that live in such conditions?
Well, what they're saying is that a 16-year-old starting out in the workforce should be paid a salary of over $41,000 regardless of the work that they do. And I simply don't agree that that's affordable. I can't remember the modelling that I was given, but I think there were tens of thousands of jobs that would be put at risk if the minimum wage went to $19.80. And we do need to balance up the generosity that the government has with other people's money with the affordability of employers to be able to pay those sorts of wages. And I think we've struck that balance pretty well.
Okay, so the balance, so you're saying that the balance is between, you know, not trying to constrain employment growth, but also being able to help support people to have more money in their pockets. But the economy is strong at the moment, and in the third quarter of 2016, unemployment fell to below 5% for the first time since 2008. So with this in mind, could you not have justified bumping it to at least $16?
Well, I go back to the point that this is a minimum wage and that employers are operating in what is an increasingly competitive market for labour. I expect that there, you know, and in fact we've seen wage growth for a number of brackets above the minimum wage. This is consistent with that, and I think it's a fair and balanced response.
That was Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, Michael Woodhouse.
But not all are pleased with this increase to the minimum wage. I spoke to the Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff about this.
Of course it's good to get an increase in the minimum wage, but it's way too low, and we keep getting these small incremental increases of 50 cents here and 50 cents there. But 50 cents just isn't going to cut it when it comes to the gap between the minimum wage and what people need to live on. It really needs a big catch-up. When the minimum wage was first set way back in the 40s, it was something like 80% of the average wage, and even in the early 70s, it was two-thirds of the average wage, which is where we think it should be now. But unfortunately, since sort of the 70s until now, there's been, you know, essentially a neoliberal small government, low transfer cost sort of attitude in government, which is the infamous 90s was a real cut in welfare payments, and the minimum wage just wasn't adjusted at all during that period of national government. And so it declined to, you know, around a third of the average wage, and now we're trying to catch up, but we never will if we take steps as big as this.
Yeah, and I mean, a 50 cents an hour increase to someone who's working full-time 40 hours is $20 a week. I don't see that making too much substantial change.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the minimum wage is now going to $15.75 an hour from the 1st of April. Well, that's very poor pay, and as listeners will know, you can't get far on that kind of wage. You certainly can't enjoy too many luxuries in life, if any. And it doesn't need to be that way. It also, you know, contributes to, you know, a low spending rate of hundreds of thousands of people who could be spending more in shops and businesses and so forth, and we could get into a more virtuous circle in terms of economic activity.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see all the points you're making. I guess the common argument, and there's a lot of concern, is would smaller businesses be able to afford to pay for the increases in wage costs?
Yeah, now, and this is something that's wheeled out always by the business community, that, you know, with increased wages, there'll be a cut in jobs. You know, it's this very fundamental belief or faith in those very simple economic arguments, sort of classical economics, that increase the cost of labour, that'll decrease the supply and decrease the jobs available. Actually, in the real world, the evidence doesn't stack up like that. Of course, there are limits to it, but we think an increase to the very bottom would actually stimulate a lot more economic activity. There is some truth that we agree with the fact that productivity in this country is far too low, and productivity increases would help the affordability of wages generally. But if you look at the last few decades, productivity is not only low, what there is not shared in any case. So this sort of economic theory that productivity increases will naturally flow through to wages hasn't been happening with our current wage system.
I guess another fear is that people might turn even more to mechanical labour because it will be cheaper in the long run. Do you see this happening with an increased wage?
There is a connection there, but, you know, automation, the jury's out on what that will mean for jobs. There has been numerous predictions for decades, if not centuries, about how machines will put us all out of work, and now we're all working longer than harder than ever. Despite, you know, rapid increases in technology in the last while. Now, it's fair to say that it looks like we've got a tsunami ahead of us in terms of technological change. But there is a connection between the cost of labour and an employer's commitment to investing in, you know, productive technology. Now, sort of conversely, the CTU argued, I think, quite correctly many years ago when the Employment Contracts Act was brought in, that will decrease labour costs, and that will incentivise employers to stay away from investing in new technology. And we think that's actually borne out, and we think that the evidence is there that New Zealand's take-up of productive technology at work has been lower as the cost of labour is lower, because there's no incentive to invest in good technology. And in fact, that's not a good thing for New Zealand, because over the longer term, we just fall further and further behind in terms of productivity per person. If you look at, you know, if you look at those countries that have higher wages and invest in higher technology, the Germanys, the Scandinavians and so forth, everyone's better off in the end. So we don't think it's a good thing, and we don't think employers should resist better technology for better production.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was the Council of Trade Unions President, Richard Wagstaff, talking about the government's announcement yesterday that minimum wage is going up by 50 cents in April. We'll be back after a quick break.
Guys, I've been scavenging in the forest all day and I... Wait, what? You're eating burgers? Where'd you get the meat? Yummy. Where's Piggy? My God, you're eating Piggy, aren't you? I've only been stuck on this island for 2 hours and already you've turned to savagery. How could you? I weep for this loss of innocence. For the darkness in your heart.
Oh, chill out, Dickie. These from Lord of the Fries. They're vegetarians.
Yeah, turns out this isn't an island at all. We're just in Myers Park.
Oh, is it chip?
Lord of the Fries is your new favourite purveyor of delicious, ethical fast food that just happens to be vegetarian and vegan too if you want. Burgers, hot dogs, sides, and of course fries in all manner of delicious sauces. Get all the info and the full menu from lordofthefries.co.nz and get you some from St. Kevin's Arcade or 1 Queen Street.
People always say to us, hey Silo Park, we love the silos, but how do you put together the perfect summer event schedule? I tell them honestly, I take inspiration from the 95BFM weekday DJs. It's The Mix. You've got Penny on a Monday, a bit dark but with poppy gems to take you by surprise, which I think perfectly describes silo cinema, because the sky is dark at night. You've got Bridge on Wednesday, it's grooves, it's buzzy, it's undoubtedly the Silo Park markets. Sigrid on a Thursday goes without saying that's silo stories, because of her voice breaks. And obviously Connor on a Friday represents that it's called Silo Park, like park life. Because he's English.
I feel like you're stretching the metaphor a bit.
No, I think it works.
Silo Park, sorting your summer with their community of good times. I'm proudly bringing you your gorgeous early Arvo weekday selections from Penny, Bridge, Sigrid and Connor. Go to 95bfm.com for show details and check out silopark.co.nz or the Silo Park Facebook. Thanks to Panuku Development Auckland.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Now today on Dear Science, AUT Professor of Chemistry Alan Blackman is back for another week before Steve Poynting returns in February. So today on the show, we're starting off with the story of medical quackery. Can you tell me a bit about this?
Oh, this is a really, really sad story. Okay, so there was a lady by the name of Naima Halda Muhammad who unfortunately got breast cancer in 2009. She was a captain in the British Army. She'd been through Sandhurst, officer training, all that sort of stuff. And so she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2009. She underwent what some might call conventional therapy. The cancer disappeared. It recurred in 2012, and she was told it was terminal. So as one probably would do in that case, she sought perhaps alternative remedies, so she went on the internet and discovered a guy by the name of Robert O. Young, who was an advocate, or is an advocate still sadly, of this thing called the alkaline diet, which essentially in a nutshell says that the pH of your blood is alkaline. It's around about 7.4, which makes it basic or alkaline, mm-hmm. Depending on which terminology you use. And so he basically says that because your blood is alkaline, therefore you shouldn't eat any acid. So all of these foods that are supposedly acidic, like meat, like sugar, like alcohol, all of this stuff, you just eliminate that from your diet. Only eat so-called alkaline foods, like all your green vegetables and everything and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, that's not a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
But he maintains that all disease comes from acidity. And so she got onto him through the internet, and as you would if you were in a terminal situation, I guess, you would be willing to try anything.
Yeah.
The treatment that she got, or the treatment in inverted commas that she got from him, cost around about 100,000 New Zealand dollars for around about 3 months, and consisted primarily of infusions of sodium bicarbonate, intravenous infusions of sodium bicarbonate.
What?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so he's got this... This guy has written books, all having the title something like The pH Miracle, and I think something like The Return of the pH Miracle, something like that. He's sold 4 million copies of these things. Okay, this is really popular stuff. To believe that it can cure cancer or for... It's just so, so wrong. So this poor lady, you know, the family got the life savings and all of that stuff to pay. She goes and lives at this ranch for 3 months or so, and sadly, no surprises, she didn't get better and she ended up dying.
Oh man,
which
that's
is
awful.
Which is just utterly, utterly appalling. It's absolutely dreadful. Okay, what's wrong with this alkaline theory? Well, number one, everything you eat goes into your stomach. The pH of your stomach's about 1.5. It's very acidic. So before you get to your intestines, where all of your food is absorbed into your body, all your nutrients, etc., it's going through a big acidic pot called your stomach. Mm. So it's utter, utter, can I say crap?
Yeah,
good.
Go for
I'll
it.
I'll say it. It's crap with a capital C. It really is. And this guy should know better. So he essentially touts himself as being a doctor, but it's been shown that he doesn't have a doctoral degree.
I read that.
From anywhere that's recognised.
Didn't he get it in the mail? He got his PhD in the mail?
Yeah. As you sadly can do. He went from a BSc to a PhD in 8 months, which, you know, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So it's just a really, really sad situation. And sadly, there are all too many people out on the internet who are quite willing to take advantage of people who are in this situation. And really, there should be a special place in hell reserved for these people. They are just evil. They're evil people who are taking advantage of people who are in a terminal situation and who really would be willing to try anything. Okay, so this I found this on the BBC website, and this formed the basis of a documentary which is called Clean Eating: The Dirty Truth, which just showed last week in Britain on BBC Two. And you can get it on YouTube. It's, if you do the search for that on YouTube, you'll find it. Mm-hmm. So I watched it last night. And it's basically a medical doctor going through and sort of looking at these sort of quack people. And it's a very, very good watch. But having found that on the BBC website, I was then looking at the Herald yesterday, and really, really unfortunately, there's another story in the Herald of this lady in Britain who, mother of four, 36 years old, she's found a lump in her breast, and rather than undergo chemotherapy, so she's been offered free on the NHS either a mastectomy or a lumpectomy and radiation treatment, but she's saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I am going to have an alkaline-based vegan diet, and that's going to cure me. She says, quote unquote, I've done a lot of scientific research into it. I'm 100% sure my cancer is emotional. I believe if I had a mastectomy, I'd be dead within 10 years. I've seen people go through chemotherapy and be very ill as a result. Others having mastectomies still not surviving. So she's absolutely convinced that all she's got to do is to follow this alkaline-based diet and she's going to get better. Now, surprise, surprise, Sarah also needs £30,000 to fund her natural treatment. She needs to get vitamin C drips, supplements, a water distiller, thermoimaging to check tumor shrinkage, and hormone testing reports, okay?
Hmm.
So there's some bastard, I'll say there, who is, you know, charging $30,000 for all of that, £30,000, sorry, for all of this sort of stuff. It's just wrong.
And just exploiting basically people's desperation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exploitation to the nth degree. There is no such thing as alternative medicine. There is medicine full stop.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. It either works or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work, it's not alternative medicine. It's just crap.
Right.
So, yeah, this sort of thing really, really gets my goat. And sadly, it just seems to be proliferating more and more given the freely available nature of stuff on the internet. You just
totally
get quacks out there who are willing to take advantage of people, and it's just so wrong. So, you know, I could go on at this for a long time. But
yeah, no, it just kind of seems to pop up again and again.
Yes,
I remember recently, I guess maybe it was a couple of years ago now, there was an Australian woman. I don't know if you remember, she was like very big on Instagram, like had a very
strong
social media presence and was advocating a vegan diet as a cure for cancer and, you know, told everybody that it cured her cancer, and it was amazing. And she wrote these books and everything. And then it turned out she actually didn't even have cancer in the end.
Even have it. Yes.
And was, like she gave all these families so much hope and like created this almost false community. And it's just like so disturbing.
Oh, God. And again, in New Zealand, I don't know, it might have been 10, 15 years ago, there was a little kid who had terminal cancer and his parents were not going to give him treatment. And they went through all the courts and stuff and they were going to give him forcible treatment. So they just as much as you can kidnap your kid, I think they just sort of took him away somewhere. And, you know, it was this again, Quack, who had this fraudulent quantum device or something like that, and was going to treat the kid like this. And of course, he ended up passing away. It's tragic. It's utterly tragic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, speaking from a position of recently losing a close family member to cancer, I know exactly that feeling of being like, any solution, we do anything, you know? And, like, that's just, like, the worst possible thing to, like, exploit.
It is.
Yeah, it's just honestly.
Anyway. It's just plain evil. And, you know, these people. So this guy, Dr. Robert Young, is now up for 3 years jail because practicing medicine without a license.
Yeah.
So, you know, all power to the courts over there, hopefully.
Totally.
Yeah.
So next up, something a little bit... hopefully we'll give the listeners a little bit less to despair about, actually more exciting perhaps. That astronomers have discovered hotter temperatures than were thought possible.
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
Well, we've got two stories about temperatures today. We've got the coldest possible temperature and we've got the hottest possible temperature. So it probably makes sense to talk about what temperature is to begin with.
Yeah, go for it. Tell us.
So temperature is basically a manifestation of motion. That's all it is. So... when things are moving, they have a particular temperature. The faster they move, essentially, the hotter the temperature. That's it in a nutshell, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So when you stop movement, you have zero temperature. So that's the coldest possible temperature that you can have. Now, we might think that a temperature of 0 degrees is cold because water freezes. That's what we use as the basis of our temperature scale, is the freezing of water. But in fact, as everybody knows, you can get colder temperatures than that, especially if you're down in the South Island up in the hills at the moment, because they're having a rubbish summer.
Yeah.
So you can get negative temperatures, of course. And then the question becomes, well, is there a coldest temperature that you can get? And the answer is yes, there is. And that coldest temperature that you can get is negative 273.15 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
Okay. And the reason that's the coldest temperature is that all motion of atoms and molecules stops at that particular temperature.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the coldest temperature. And we call that zero Kelvin. That's another temperature scale that we can use, is the Kelvin scale. And that's the zero of temperature where all motion stops. Now, so potentially we should be able to get to zero Kelvin, but we can't, because there's a thing called the third law of thermodynamics, which says that you cannot get to zero Kelvin. Okay, you can't have no motion. That's a fundamental law of physics, I say it, and is encompassed in a thing called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which we're certainly not going to go into here.
Sounds very complicated.
But you can't get to zero, but you can get really, 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 really close to zero. So researchers over in Colorado at the National Institute of Standards have just recorded the coldest known temperature. And that temperature is 0.00036 Kelvin, okay? So that's...
really close.
That's really close. That's negative 273.14964 degrees Celsius, okay? So that's as close to absolute zero as anybody has got before.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think, okay, whoop-de-doo, so this is just some bloody academic palaver. but it's not really, because cold temperatures are of interest because the next generation of computers that we're going to use are going to be things called quantum computers. And the current computers that we use rely on a binary language. So you're either a zero or a one, basically.
Yeah.
That's the way that all computers work. However, there are these states of matter called qubits, which can be both simultaneously zero and one at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And these are going to be the foundation of new computers that are going to be infinitely faster than what we've got at the moment. But they're only going to operate at very, very cold temperatures, because you can't have any of these thermal motion. You can't have these things moving very much, otherwise they just sort of fall apart, these qubit things. So it's of interest to get as cold as we possibly can in order to investigate these new computers. So it's not just some academic nonsense.
It
really is going to have real-world applications. So that's why a lot of people are putting a lot of money into this sort of stuff.
Cool. That's really
literally
awesome.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. Literally cool. So talk to me about the timeline for this. So they've discovered this. How is this going to take it, come into effect in terms of technological development, do you think?
That's a really good question. A lot of people are trying to answer that question right at the moment. So, any guess is a guess. Maybe, you know, the next 5 years. I believe there's an example of an operating quantum computer reported, I think, last year or so, but they're still not quite sure whether it's actually doing what it says it's right. meant to be doing. So, but as I say, you know, whoever makes the big breakthrough on this, they're going to make gazillions. So a lot of people are putting a lot of money
absolutely
into this sort of stuff.
So
that's the coldest temperature.
And then on the other end of the spectrum,
indeed, and in the same week as well, who'd have thunk it? So astronomers have been busy looking at a quasar. And a quasar is a thing called, is an abbreviation for quasi-stellar object. So these were extraordinarily bright things in the sky that gave out a truckload of radiation, and people sort of didn't really know what they were sort of way back in the 50s, 60s or so, I think. And so, for example, these quasars put out more luminosity, or they're more luminous than the entire Milky Way, and they're about the size of the solar system. So it's just, it just boggles the mind, you know, all the millions and millions and millions of stars in the Milky Way, and these things put out more light than those. So quite amazing. But what has been done recently is that astronomers have been getting a really, really good view of these very, very, very distant quasars, and the way that they do that is they use an orbiting Russian radio telescope, which is out around the orbit of the moon, plus an Earth-based telescope as well, and essentially sort of merge the images and everything and get a really good view of these things. And apparently it's equivalent to a golf ball on the moon, so being able to see a golf ball on the moon, which is pretty impressive. And anyway, the guts of it is that as a result of this, they found that these things are putting out way more radiation than was thought. And using some calculations, they've estimated that these, that this particular quasar has got a temperature of around about 40 million degrees Celsius.
Wow.
Sorry, not 40 million, 40 trillion, sorry.
Even
more wow, yes, yes. So current theory said that the maximum possible temperature you should be able to get, and remember temperature is all about motion, that's what's leading to these things, is around about 1 trillion degrees Celsius. So they're way, way higher, so the question then becomes why. So people are going to have to rethink their theories. So for comparison on this, the surface of the sun is around about 5,500 degrees Celsius, and the middle of the sun is around about 15 million degrees Celsius. So we're talking
way more than that.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Yeah, yeah, we're talking millions and millions more, millions and millions higher temperature than that. So, you know, orders of magnitude, which is quite remarkable. So people are going to have to look at the theories and
reassess.
Yeah, and basically reassess. So, you know, it's a big scientific discovery, as astronomers seem always to do, because there's a vast amount to study out there. And
absolutely.
With the better and better equipment that you get, the more you're able to see, et cetera, et cetera. So,
so it's kind of, they've discovered that these particles actually move faster than anyone could have thought? Is that kind of...
Well, that's a really good question, because at the middle of a quasar is a black hole, and really people aren't sure what actually happens to matter in a black hole, because black holes supposedly eats matter. Supposedly once matter gets in, then it just can't get out. Even light, once light goes into a black hole, it can't get out because of the enormous gravitational field in there. So whatever process is going on there, and we probably don't really appreciate or understand that exactly yet, it's generating enormous, enormous temperatures. So things that we just can't comprehend, basically.
Right.
So, you know, people get back to the drawing board and reassess their theories and see what they can come up with.
So is this kind of similar to the one last week where it's kind of changing the rules, breaking the rules?
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yeah, that'd be a similar sort of thing. So, and that's the beauty of science, is that it's ever-changing. We only know what we know today, and tomorrow it could be entirely different.
Totally, that it's nothing is like this fixed...
Fixed,
unchangeable rule that, that this is just the extent to what we know.
Exactly,
For sure. Important distinction to make. awesome. Well, thank you for joining us again this week.
Not a problem.
And you'll be back again for one more week next week before Steve gets back.
Okay.
Awesome.
Look,
we will see you then, Alan.
Okay, cool. Thanks. See
ya.
That was Dear Science. This Saturday at Silo Park, Silo Sessions with Don McGlashan, SJD, Nadia Reid and LA, all for free. January's edition of the Silo Park Institution features stunning solo and acoustic sets from some of our local singer-songwriting luminaries. Featuring the immortal Don McGlashan, critical darling SJD, the incredible Nadia Reid, and up-and-coming Auckland duo LA. Silo Sessions, this Saturday, January 28th from 12 p.m. Silopark.co.nz or Facebook for more info. Thanks to Panuku Development Auckland.
Honey, wake up! I think I hear noises!
Oh, it's probably just the cats. They have soccer in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute! Our cats are dead!
Morning, you lovebirds!
Hannah!
It's crazy.
great to see you guys. I think you might like some smashed Avon toast.
Aww. Hannah, honestly, you're too much. Mm. How'd you get in this time?
How about a heaping bowl of guacamole? Yeah, come on.
Well, hey.
Yeah.
Mornings.
Weekday mornings from 7, wake up and smell the bee with your kindly friend Hannah. BFM Breakfast is the parsley sprig on your scrambled morning, the snap, crackle and pop Rice Krispies in your plain old bowl of life. BFM Breakfast, weekdays from 7 till 10, proudly brought to you by Orcon, the meanest IS.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.